They tell us a couple of things. First of all, they tell us about the culture of the time, how play was being expressed in new ways during that period of time, but also what the interaction of technology with society was. Video games are the way that most people become familiar with the computer world. They're the way that we learn to speak digital, in a sense. And so kids who are growing up as digital natives now and have been now for a few generations really learn how to speak digital through their video games and electronic games. So it's in many ways the first way we learn how to interact and speak with computers. Even after that, they become an important part of our lives throughout. And one of the things that we see happening is that people really don't stop playing games as they get older. They may change how often they play or what they play, but whether they're playing on their smartphone or on their computer or their console, they continue to make games be part of their lives on an ongoing basis.
John Paul, how do you go about deciding what's important enough to keep?
Well, when we're exploring the history of video games, we're looking at a number of different important factors deciding what we should keep. So, for instance, was a game popular? Might be a particular question that we would look at. Or is a game noteworthy for some reason? Sometimes that's good, sometimes that's bad. Maybe it's notorious more than noteworthy. But often, what does a game tell us about maybe what people enjoyed playing, what their values were, what was popular, how technology was shifting?
How did you go about getting the 100,000 plus items that you currently have? And how do you go about sourcing what it is that you're looking for to add to your collections there?
So when we're building a collection of video games and other forms of electronic play, we get the materials from a wide variety of sources. Sometimes people come to us and say, hey, I have this great old game I love, but I'm not playing it anymore. Do you want it? Sometimes we need a game for an exhibit or for a certain scholarly purpose, and so we go out and acquire it. We have almost 300 arcade games and pinball games that are pretty large. And most of those we've had to purchase over the years, but we do get quite a few donations. And those are some of the favorite ones of people who remember going back and playing those games. Maybe if they were growing up in the 80s, for instance, they want to go back and play Pac-Man again or Donkey Kong. So they love coming to the museum and play those. And so we can provide those experiences by acquiring those. We also work a lot with the people who created these games. And that's something really important because games are probably the dominant media form of the 21st century. And so just as people look at great authors who wrote important texts or great movie makers who made important films, people now and in the future are and will be studying video games and the people who created them. And so we want to collect materials that document how the games were made, what decisions were made along the way. And so we work a lot with the creators of games and the people who founded businesses related to games to preserve their materials as well.
John Paul, have you always had an interest in gaming? I note that you've got a doctorate in American cultural studies with an emphasis on the history of science. But has this always been in the back of your mind that you wouldn't mind working for a place like the International Center for the History of Electronic Games?
Yeah, when I tell people where I work, they often think of it as a dream job. It really is wonderful. And I get a lot of questions. So how do I get that sort of job? So, yes, I've been using computers and computer games pretty much since I was 10 or 11 or so. I was born in 1969, and I had some early access to computers. Now, interestingly, my parents wouldn't buy me an Atari 2600, which was the coveted game system of the time. And I think they thought it was going to be a waste of time. But they did manage to buy me a computer, or buy our family a computer, and so I got to use that and program on that and do serious things like that. And luckily, the computer also came with some games along with it. And so from early on, I've been playing games and learning how to make them early on. Initially, I didn't think I was going to study games. And my emphasis was on 19th century American history. And when I was at the Strong National Museum of Play, we began looking at how play was changing. We have the world's biggest play collection, toys, dolls, games. And we said, video games are having this amazing effect on play. We need to represent them. How are they different from earlier forms of play? How are they the same? And as it turned out, I was sort of the logical person with the training, the background, and the inclination to really get into this area of study and to build this collection. It's been a lot of fun, and I've worked with a lot of really smart people who've helped me not only determine what games to get and how to acquire them, but also maintain them on an ongoing basis, because that's one of the biggest challenges for museums or anyone collecting games, is how do you keep these going?
Well, what are some of those obstacles that you face with the types of video games and some of those earlier games that we're talking about in keeping them good and in, I suppose, museum condition?
Right. So we have this collection, amazing collection, for instance, of board games. And board games, it's relatively simple to keep a board game from the 1800s in good condition. If you keep it in the right environment where there's constant level of temperature and humidity and it's away from light. Video games and electronic games are much more complicated because they not only have the physical medium in older games, but they also have an electronic storage piece to them that may be on magnetic storage or optical storage, and that has a limited lifespan. In addition, they need to interact with hardware, and so you need to keep that hardware going. And so what happens and what we've evolved is an approach that looks at a variety of different methods of maintaining that information. Those methods for maintaining the information on a video game and keeping it playable may range from acquiring the original equipment to run it and keeping the game itself, or maybe doing a video capture of the gameplay itself that people are doing as they play the game, or maybe migrating the data from the original disc, say those old 5 1/4 inch floppies, onto a type of storage that we can keep going into the future, along with collecting materials around the game itself, media about the games, magazine articles, or videos about the game, and also the papers of the people who created the games and also market it and showed how the games were received. So it's a very holistic way of looking at how we preserve these things. And it's a challenge, an ongoing challenge. You're always dealing with new challenges as the medium itself continues to change.
I'm Rhianna Patrick, and this is ABC Local Radio. John Paul Dyson is my guest, and he's the director of the International Centre for the History of Electronic Games, but also the VP of Exhibits at The Strong, which is the National Museum of Play in New York. John Paul, when we talk about the history of play, what is the history of play, particularly in the US?
Well, play is something that everyone does. All humans play. In fact, all mammals play, and even some birds. Ravens, for instance, are great players. And so on the one hand, play is constant. You see children or even animals engaging in rough and tumble play, for instance, or games of chase. And so play is biologically determined, but it's also culturally expressed in very different ways. And so as you chart the history of play, you see changes in values. You see how society's values change. So for instance, in board games, many early 19th century board games were very moralistic in terms of the values they taught. For instance, wealth games often tried to teach character first and foremost as a means to wealth. Well, by the time you get to the 20th century, a game like Monopoly, it's not so much about teaching character as it is about bankrupting your opponent. And so as games change, they reflect and sometimes they even determine, I think, changes in society itself. And so there's that give and take between the constant ways that play stays the same and also the way it changes. If I could offer an example, for instance, of how we might look at how play might change, the very controversial subject, for instance, is violence in video games. There are a lot of games that are a class of video games that are called some first-person shooters. And these are games in which players are shooting often opponents with realistic-looking guns. So the question is this a new form of play, or is this the same sort of play that kids are engaging in when they're playing cops and robbers in the backyard? And we have toy guns going back hundreds of years. So is this a different sort of play, or is this the same play? And I think these are the questions that we try to engage in as we look at how play develops over time in the United States and around the world.
Well, John Paul, I mean, do you see those moralistic elements that you mentioned in those earlier board games now crossing over to some of the video games or the gaming culture that we have today, where some of those games that you mentioned, like the, you know, first-person shooter ones, that there are those elements of ethical dilemmas that the players are placed in themselves?
Right. So, for instance, some games do this as part of the game itself, present ethical moral dilemmas. So a game series based on the television show The Walking Dead, for instance, would often put characters in ethical dilemmas they'd have to choose. Some games a category of games that's sometimes called serious games or games for change are very explicitly about using games as a vehicle for social change, whatever cause that they want it to push, to raise awareness about an issue or to move players in a very emotional way. And this is true with video games, and also many board games as well, too, are doing this now. And so it's an interesting tension always with games, because games and play, they still need to be fun. And you need to have people engage it and for its own sake. And so how do you use a game to advance a social and moral message? It's always a tricky challenge. Sometimes it's done very well. Sometimes it's not done as effectively.
John Paul, when it comes to some of those items, not only in the Centre for Electronic Games, but also your work at The Strong, do you have any objects that you believe are quite important to that fabric of not only the history of play, but also showing the evolution of that play?
Yeah, we have some really amazing items at The Strong, National Museum of Play. So a couple, for instance, two I can think of that come readily to mind. We have the prototype for Monopoly, which was created by Charles Darrow, someone who was unemployed during the Great Depression and created this wealth game. And it's a round game. He made it, handmade it, it's for his dining room table. But that game itself links to an older game called the Landlord's Game, which was created by Lizzie Maggie, who was a woman who believed that monopolies were evil and we needed to, in effect, redistribute property or wealth through taxing land. And so it's one of these ironies that Monopoly, which is the ultimate sort of American capitalist game, but bankrupt your opponent, really actually is the same playstyle from this earlier game that was a social critique of monopolies and of great wealth. That's one example. Another item in our collection, for instance, I think of that's very expressive of how games and toys shape culture are a couple of items related to Barbie and G.I. Joe, perhaps two of the most iconic dolls and action figures in the history of manufactured toys. And so in 1993, a group was really concerned about the ways that Barbie, for instance, conveyed certain gender images to girls, but expectations. And there was a Teen Talk Barbie that came out. And it was notorious for uttering certain phrases like, let's go shopping or math class is hard. And at the same time, a talking G.I. Joe was issued. And it said, things like, get ready, men, and let's attack, things like that. And so a group said, okay, what are the gender expectations that these toys are putting on children? How are the toys themselves not only merely perhaps reflecting inborn tendencies in boys and girls, but how are they maybe shaping these in certain ways? So what this Barbie Liberation Organization, the BLO, did was quite ingenious. They actually went into stores, took out a few hundred of these talking G.I. Joes and talking Barbies and switched the voice boxes on them and put them back into the stores. And so Christmas morning or whenever the people got these gifts, little Susie opened her Teen Talk Barbie and heard attack, come on, men. And little Johnny opened up his Fighting Duke G.I. Joe doll and heard, let's go shopping and math class is hard. And it was a brilliant way to show that toys can shape our culture and can impact the way that children, boys and girls, see themselves as they grow up.
John Paul, this might sound like a really stupid question, but do you get to play as part of your job?
I would love it if all I did was go into work and be able to play. Unfortunately, like pretty much anyone who works, most of the time it's emails or meetings or doing other things that we don't necessarily want to be doing at that moment. I wear a couple hats at the museum. One is as a historian and building this collection, but the other is also creating exhibits that are very interactive and that not only convey lots of information and show amazing artifacts, but also give people a chance to play in ways that relate to the interpretive subject we're exploring. So if an exhibit is on history of dolls, you want to have a large oversized dollhouse that kids can go in and play. Or if it's on video games, you want to be able to play video games. And so I need to maintain a playful spirit and play as much as I can to think about what aspects of play are fun and what will be appealing to guests. But do I get to play as much as I like? No, unfortunately not. But the work itself is awful playful and a lot of fun.
John Paul Dyson is the director of the International Centre for the History of Electronic Games and also the VP of Exhibits at The Strong, the National Museum of Play in New York. And he's my guest this evening on ABC Local Radio. John Paul, I mean, on those exhibits, I mean, it must be just absolute frustration for a child that comes into a museum that's all about games, but they can't touch anything. How do you get that fine line between having that interactive element that a child can understand and that is tangible for a child, but obviously keeping your collection behind glass? I mean, is that a fine line that you tread when you are considering these exhibits?
Yeah, we always want to both protect the objects, and we have more than 450,000 games and toys and dolls and video games in the collection. We need to protect those, and we need to preserve them as any museum would, as an art museum would protect a precious painting, or a science museum protect a fossil. But we also want to make these experiences tangible to people. So, for instance, when we did an exhibit on science fiction this summer, we talked a lot about rockets and their relationship, toy rockets in relationship to the space race in the 1960s and people's expectation of space travel. But we also created a place where people could make their own rocket and launch it into space. Or we took a video game like Super Mario Brothers and we blew up a giant television about 20 feet wide. And so people could play with oversized version of it in a way they never got to play Super Mario Brothers before. And so we want to create unique experiences for people, something that brings them in touch with those toys.
John Paul, as the gaming culture evolves, do you think that consoles will eventually become obsolete? How does the centre collect those online games and those app-based games? And what does the future hold in the changes that you're going to see as part of what you collect?
Definitely one of the big trends that we're seeing in video games is the rise of digital-based content, and in which the game you're buying is probably or is often no longer coming on a disc or a CD-ROM or cartridge or whatever these traditional media were that stored discs. So that presents us with a number of challenges. What does it mean to preserve a game that's on a smartphone or that's existing in the cloud, for instance, out there, that's relying on a server somewhere? So a big class of games is something called MMOs, Massively Multiplayer Online Game. World of Warcraft is the most famous. Well, what does it mean to preserve a game like that? And in that case, it is challenging because there are a number of issues here. First of all, the game itself may be relying on a server that's owned by a company. And when that server goes down, will players even have access to it? And secondly, is that game, even if you could play a version of that game, if that game, for instance, relies on a community of players, if you, say, had a shell of the game running, but there was no one there to play it with you, what does that mean? So in that case, we might do something like, for instance, videotape play of the game. An analogy would be to a sporting event, a game like baseball or football or rugby or something like that. Well, what does it mean to preserve that game? Well, you might preserve materials from that game. You might preserve memories that people have of that game. You might preserve video of the game being played. And so we think about all these different ways of approaching, for instance, a sport, how you preserve that, in many ways are similar with video games. And we're always doing our best to try to capture the essence of what was important about games at that particular moment in time. What was their impact on culture? What were some of the most significant games? And you're always doing the best you can, but you will always be missing some elements of that, I'm sure, down in the future.
Finally, John Paul, is there something missing from the collection that you would love to add to it?
Well, since I'm talking to an Australian audience, I'd say one thing is we love to have more materials that represent the Australian experience in developing games and playing games. And we really believe that video gaming is interconnected worldwide, and we can't tell that story of video games in the United States without recognizing how video games developed in Australia. So in the 1980s, for instance, there were a lot of important video games being developed in Australia. Going forward, a game like The Hobbit, for instance, which was an early text-based adventure, was developed in Australia. And so we love more materials from if any of your listeners want to contact us and say, oh, I have some of my old games, or I have some things that I used to play, I'd love to send them to you. We'd be interested in talking to them. Or people who develop games there said we would love to do that. And then I think that ties in with something else is, in some ways, the games themselves are the easiest things to collect. And then I think we are able to get stuff from materials that people created in making the games, the business side of games, the creator side of games. But equally important to me is getting materials that represent what the meaning of the game was for the player. And so that drawing that the child does, you know, based on this fantasy world they create out of playing a video game, or the note someone made while playing a game, that stuff may not be the most exciting stuff always for, you know, a visitor to the museum, but for scholars, and we have a lot of scholars who come to our museum, that really tells you something about the impact of games on society. Plus, I always want the games that I love. I want to make sure that they're in the museum, too.
So no doubt an Atari 2600 is the one thing that you go to.
Right, as well as some of my favorite arcade games. There's a certain bias in that collecting side of things.